This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. One thing is for sure about this COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of people got sick and a lot of people went hungry.
It is abundantly clear that COVID's economic and social repercussions have worsened food and nutrition insecurity in our communities.
That's Barbara Ferrer from the LA County Department of Public Health at a Food Day Summit today. Remember the miles-long lines of cars for food giveaways last year? According to a report from USC, 1 in 3 LA County households experienced food insecurity in 2020, meaning that they struggled to provide the family with 3 meals a day. And the problem persists. It's still true for 1 in 10 households in LA County at this point. Well, these days, Department of Public Health officials are not just thinking about providing food. They're also asking, is it healthy food? Here's Deepa Shah Patel, who heads up nutrition programs there.
Largely, the conversation around hunger often leads to a conversation about getting food to people, inevitably, right? Getting more food to people in need. But what I think is often missing in that conversation is the quality of food.
She says a significant portion of LA residents experience some kind of diet-related chronic disease, such as obesity or type 2 diabetes, especially in low-income communities and communities of color.
When we're talking about getting food to people and then these communities all already facing chronic diseases, we want to make sure that we're not exacerbating any diseases or conditions.
In other words, unhealthy food could make problems that already plague poor families worse. But just as we saw massive innovation when it came to getting food to people in need, there's also innovation happening to make sure that food is packed with nutrients. KCRW's Catherine Barnes reports on a few ideas that are picking up steam.
Let's start with food banks. They were indispensable organizations at the height of COVID. In June and July of 2020, the LA County Food Bank reached nearly 1.5 million people. It continues to feed about 900,000 every month, double that of pre-pandemic levels. And their focus isn't just on providing food. It's making sure fruits and vegetables make up the bulk of their donations. Here's President Michael Flood.
We were one of the first food banks back about 15 or 16 years ago to start rating the nutrient content of the food coming in and saying no to some donors and just saying thank you, but no thank you.
He says fresh produce is now the number one food category flowing through LA's food bank. But providing healthier food is only one way to up nutrition levels. There's also incentivizing people to make healthier choices when they're out shopping on their own. You can see how that works here at the Route 1 Farmers Market near the Vandenberg Air Force Base in northern Santa Barbara County. As shoppers line up at the manager's booth to swipe their credit cards in exchange for market tokens, folks using EBT cards, also known as SNAP benefits or food stamps, get a special deal.
So we can run your card for however much you'd like to spend in the market, but we can actually double the first $15.
Okay.
So how much would you like to charge your card for today?
$15
today. $15? And we'll give you another $15, so you'll have $30 to spend in the market.
Great.
Yeah.
The USDA provides grants to grocery stores and nonprofits, like this market, that agree to double EBT purchases spent on fruits and veggies. About 25 people a week take advantage of this market match program, with more learning about it each Sunday.
Buen día.
Buen día.
Gracias.
Okay, gracias.
Thank you.
Kel Ferguson stops by to grab her tokens. She's been using the program for about 2 years.
EBT changed how I interact with food, how important it is to me. I didn't really know how to cook vegetables at all until finding out about the EBT program, and I was just trying to stretch my dollar. And there was a sign up that literally said, stretch your dollar, stretch your EBT, go to the farmer's market.
Shopping at the market became cheaper than shopping at the grocery store, she says. And she noticed when vendors saw she was paying with EBT tokens, they often threw in a little extra.
There's the nutrition aspect where I think I'm getting better nutrients. But there's also all this intention that I have. When I wake up in the morning and I make something for myself or I eat something that I have prepared, I feel better about my choices already.
Now, not all farmers markets offer market match. In LA, for example, only about half do. It's even less common for grocery stores to double SNAP benefits for produce. According to LA County, the only brick-and-mortar retailer participating in LA is Northgate Market. They offer it at six of their stores in SoCal right now, including one in Inglewood and one in South LA. But they plan to expand to all their 42 locations early next year. Another innovative approach to helping people choose healthy food is taking place at doctor's offices. You know how you tend to follow your doctor's advice when it comes to what medicine to take, but maybe slack off a bit when it comes to diet and exercise? What if they could write you a prescription for fruits and veggies, subsidized through your health insurance, just like drugs? That's what David Kerr is trying out in Santa Barbara.
Hi, my name's David Kerr. I'm the Director of Research and Innovation here at Sanson Diabetes Research Institute.
He says most forms of diabetes can be treated or prevented altogether by making healthier eating choices. And he wants to make that choice easier to make.
Now, I'm a great believer that I don't think people wake up in the morning and say, I am going to eat really bad food today. I'm determined to eat terrible food because I want to be ill. There's something much more to this, and this starts to get into the politics of food, access to better food, and the cost of better food. So with that in mind, we piloted a small program where we asked the simple question, what if we provide better food to an at-risk population? Do you think they'll benefit? And they did.
The pilot began in Santa Barbara a couple years ago with 30 people who had or were at risk of diabetes. Their doctor wrote a prescription for fresh produce. The diabetes clinic measured their weight, waist circumference, blood pressure, and levels of sleep and pain. Patients then filled the prescription, not at a pharmacy, but by picking up a free weekly box of local fruits and vegetables. After 10 weeks, the clinic took those same measurements.
And what we've found, and we've published on this, is that their blood pressure comes tumbling down. Their waist circumference goes down. We also find that for those who had diabetes in this population, their blood glucose control improved, really quite markedly. And if I had a drug that did all those three things, it'd be a blockbuster.
The program has now expanded to about 400 people, including Christy and her husband, Neftali, who didn't want to share their last name due to health privacy.
Y consumíamos mucha fruta y verdura, pero cuando venimos a este país, pues las prisas y todo nos cambió y nos revolucionó la vida.
Christy says they ate a lot of fruits and vegetables when they lived in Mexico, but when they moved to California about 20 years ago, everything changed. They got busy, produce was more expensive, and they went with what was cheaper and more available where they could shop. Kerr says that's all too common for immigrants.
People who move to the United States, the first and worst thing that happens is they adopt a traditional American diet, which is ultra-processed, energy-dense, really bad for your food. We're trying to change that.
Christy lists off what they get in their produce box.
Elote, espinaca, calabacitas, aguacate, cilantro.
Corn, lechuga, spinach, zucchini, avocado, cilantro, lettuce, carrots. Talk about big pharma. She says the program has reawakened in her a love of cooking vegetarian. Plus, she's sleeping better and has lost weight. Produce prescriptions and nutrition incentives are only two on a long list of possible solutions. There are veggie rescue organizations, gleaning programs, cooking classes at public libraries aimed at those on a budget. And let's not forget affordable housing, since a major barrier to cooking healthy meals is simply not having an adequate kitchen space. It's a both-and approach. And from doctors, to farmers, to eaters like you and me, there's plenty of room at the table. For KCRW, I'm Catherine Barnes.
Coming up, female, non-binary, and LA theater playwrights of color continue to lament how white and male things are on the stage, how the giant theatership is very slow and very difficult to move. It's yours on the other side of this on KCRW. Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The Center Theater Group recently announced its 2022 season. 10 plays would be performed at the Mark Taper Forum in Kirk Douglas Theater after almost a 2-year hiatus. Playwright Jeremy O. Harris, known for his work Slave Play, was included in the list. Notably absent were female playwrights. Out of the 10, only one was a woman. Many women spoke out about the news, and then Harris threatened to withdraw his play from the season if the Center Theater Group didn't act. And at that point, CTG issued an apology and committed to programming from women and non-binary playwrights for the following season, which was welcome news for some, but still fell short for many. So why did it take the objection of a male playwright to happen before CTG took action? If LA Theater is incorporating more BIPOC players, why are women still getting left behind? To look into these issues, Jenny Webb is here. She's a playwright and co-founder of LAFPI. That's the Los Angeles Female Playwright Initiative. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
And Diana Bourbano is a playwright and an actor who joins us as well. Diana, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Jenny, I'm going to start with you. How do you feel about this news that, Center Theater Group and the slate for the following year will be all female and non-binary playwrights?
Well, you know, of course, that it's a fantastic thing. But, you know, of course, it's a long time coming. And of course, we all are going, okay, and what's after that? I mean, this isn't a new issue. This, you know, this fight has been going on for a long time. You know, where are the women? Where are the women? Where are the women? So we keep going, you know, and, you know, I think that it's fantastic these women, you know, are out there holding somebody accountable.
Diana, in response to what happened over there at Center Theater Group, playwright Teresa Rebeck wrote a New York Times op-ed, the title being "A Racial Reckoning is Underway in Theater. Where is the Gender Reckoning?" Do you feel like there's been a racial reckoning that's underway?
Yeah, you know, I wonder about that. I sometimes wonder about that because that really feels a little bit of the problem sometimes with the gender equity idea is that somehow the BIPOC women are going to have equal footing, and we definitely still don't. So I do have a little bit of a problem with that because I feel like there's all sorts of reckonings that have to happen and be torn down before anything is going to get built up. I mean, I got the Dramatists Guild, The Count, which is a list of produced playwrights, right? And I'm looking at it right now, and it says the percentage of produced playwrights in the last time we did the count is 68% men and 31% women, female, and that's all over the country, with less than 1% non-binary. But then if you look at it by race, it's 80% white and 20% BIPOC. So I'm not entirely sure that a racial reckoning is actually happening, or it's just being given a lot of lip service.
And in the day-to-day, Diana, you know, as a person of color and as a woman, do you feel like the cards are doubly stacked against you?
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Like the Latinx community that I belong to, we're really supportive of each other. It's, you know, Luis Alfaro, who is currently one of the associate artistic directors at CTG, who is a mentor and a friend, has always been the kind of person who, if there's an opportunity, he will, you know, reach back and pull up. And he pulls up equally female, male, non-binary, gay, straight, you know, because we have community, you know? So that's what's, for me, is really, really important, is that kind of a community. But it has been difficult. I mean, I work in another very large theater company here in the Southland. And while I think it does a much better job at parity and racial equity, it's still hard to get seen. It's a really hard thing to do, you know. And one of the things that I always talk about is that somehow the idea of universality that we've been sort of fed is that it's a white man's story. And the white man's story, like, for example, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, that Willie Loman is the universal character. But he isn't. Not for me, certainly. I will certainly have empathy for that story, but it doesn't speak to me. What I feel we really need to start thinking about is that what we need is specificity of story, own stories. You know, people's stories get seen on stage, and if it's a story by a Pakistani writer, an Iranian writer, a Salvadoran writer, in that specificity is where we're going to find connection and empathy, not necessarily because the top of the pyramid is, you know, this one person who happen to be the people who are running the theaters, which of course that's why they love them and consider them the universal, because it's their universal. So that's definitely something that I think we need to really, really look into and rip apart.
I asked you all at the outset, you know, why did it take a famous playwright to, you know, threaten to pull out in order for change to happen? And I wonder, and I'll ask you, and Diana, I'll ask you first, you know, what is going on, do you think? I mean, is it just, has it always been a man's world, the theater? Or, I mean, how do you change that? Is it negligence? Is it being overlooked? What's going on here?
It is leadership. It's leadership. I don't think anybody is doing it because, you know, it's a melodrama villain with a twirling mustache saying no women and no BIPOC on stage. I think, but the thing is, the people who pick the shows are majority older white men, right? So the other people don't often get invited to the table.
So the shows are being created. The shows are being created by women and by people of color. It's the fact that it's men who are looking at these shows and picking other male playwrights.
Well, sure. I mean, the CTG, the people at CTG, they only have one woman on their group right now. So, and you do hear a lot, like, I can't, you know, I don't relate to that story. I don't, you know, you'll see people like Sarah Rule has had people say, well, I don't get that. That really doesn't speak to me. Well, you know, occasionally things don't speak to you completely, but you can come and be empathetic about it, you know, and learn something new. I think it's definitely like the leadership of CTG is going to be where the change happens. And my big question right now is, who's going to pick the leader? Is it going to be all white men picking another white man, which is possible, you know, or is it going to be a greater range of people who will choose somebody who will maybe look at the fact that Los Angeles is a hugely Latino city? You know, there's barely any Latino playwrights on that stage at all. So, you know, there's just a lot of stuff that needs to be talked about. And I really do think it comes down to who's picking the plays, who's the leadership. And just one last thing, and then I'll stop talking. It's an LA theater. It's an LA theater, right? Where are the LA playwrights? It's a big deal. It's a big deal.
I mean, Jenny, obviously it's a big deal. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, we're the local playwrights. It comes down to, for years, women have heard this. They've heard, well, we didn't intend to pick all white men. Those were just the best plays. I mean, that happens over and over again. So it's all about expanding the circles, expanding your circles. Stop normalizing, like Diana said, oh, this is the story. Of course, it's the story everybody wants to see. Stop underestimating audiences. I mean, who knows? If they do this all female season, who knows what will happen? You know, women have sort of ghettoized. BIPOC playwrights have been ghettoized. Oh, we're doing this. This is our black play. This is our Latino play. Mm-hmm. This is our woman play for the season. But, you know, the real plays. So, you know, it's very interesting because in sort of the gender parity movement for a while, and I've been working, both Diana and I are part of a group called Honor Roll, which is sort of women playwrights over 40 who have been fighting this fight for a long time of being sort of invisible, is once you see, you can't unsee. It's like, oh, look, where are the women playwrights? But what you can do, or what they can do, is look the other way. And so it takes those of us over and over again to say, no, back here, and hold them accountable. And that, I mean, it gets exhausting, but if that's what it needs to be done, that's what needs to be done. And I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, people, oh, we're playing it safe. We're doing this, you know, these old chestnuts, which are old white men. But then you look at the lists of most produced plays that American Theatre puts out every year. And for the last, I don't know how many years, over half of them have been by women. And it's, you know, statistically, plays by women do better at the box office on Broadway. Women buy the tickets. So I think this is a fantastic time right now when we're sort of reframing everything, hopefully, when theater, we're getting back into the theaters to kind of really start working intersectionally. Working, look, if it's not a safe place for one person, it's not a safe place for everybody. Let's get those stories out there. Let's open ourselves up to new stories. Let's not, you know, be expected to throw somebody over the bus. Oh, I'm a woman. Oh, no, 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 you can't. You're a Latina woman. No, 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 I've got the woman slot. You know.
Right.
Well said. You know, really work together in sort of supporting everybody so that stories get out there, new voices get out there. And I'm saying new voices get out there, you know, and that we help each other to do just that.
It seems like theater in general is like this giant ship, right? And we've been just cruising down the sea, you know, with men doing this and making the decisions, and a lot of playwrights are men. And then all of a sudden, there are a lot of people who, you know, believe that it's just a hard ship to turn. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. But let me say with this is that it's a precarious ship in the first place. It's a, 100%. You know, it's a ship that's, yeah, it's a ship taking a risky journey in the first place. So I understand, you know, artistic directors wanting to play it safe. Oh, this worked. This has worked for 10 years. Let's keep doing it. But so, you know, there's part of me that says, yeah, I get that. It's risky for all of us. But yeah, it has to turn because it's going to sink if it doesn't.
Well, yeah, and I just want to, it's funny because I use this a lot too, this metaphor a lot, and some of the smaller theater companies who are more agile are like speedboats, right? They turn right around and they say, okay, we're going to do this BIPOC playwright, we're going to do this woman, we're going to do an all-woman season, because maybe they don't have as much of everything riding on an audience that they think they have to please. I think a huge thing that all the theaters have to do is really have a reckoning as to how they're going to build audiences, BIPOC audiences especially, and bring them to the theater. And the theater is either going to be really creaky or really exciting, right? So, and I'm all for the exciting thing. And exciting means bringing new audiences in and having people like argue about the shows and not like it and want to fight about it. I think that's what makes it fun. Who wants to go to see the same thing that everybody's just going to be like, oh yeah, that was terrific. Clap, clap, clap. No, let's have a little bit of a battle in there too.
Well, and it's very interesting that there's a conversation after the pandemic about, oh, well, we'll just do the same season we were going to do the pandemic, before the pandemic, mm-hmm. and everything right. That's happened during these past 2 years. And I'm sorry, something is very wrong with us if we don't look back at the last 2 years and have something profoundly changed and, you know, have a new perspective.
That's right. I ended up having to pull one of my plays because I really had to think about, I have to put my money where my mouth is. You know, if I'm going to do all this EDI work and really, really work, look hard at decentering myself and centering other writers of color, then I have to do what I have to do. And if that means pulling a play from a problematic company, that's what you have to do. And it's really hard. But, you know, if I can do it, and I'm really not anybody very much, hopefully the bigger theaters can follow suit.
Well, thank you both for coming on today to talk about it. Jenny Webb, a playwright and co-founder of the L.A. Female Playwright Initiative, and Diana Bourbono, playwright and actor here in L.A. as well. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for coming along with us today. Next week, a trip to a place with pretty much every kind of plant that's indigenous to Southern California, and how those plants are vital to the health of the local ecosystem, particularly during a time of climate change. You know, it's getting warmer and drier. Also, the thoughts of a librarian who's seen so much change, ups and downs, in his 4 decades of service at the Downtown Central Library. That story, all with new episodes of Greater LA next week on KCRW. Join us anytime, by the way, at kcrw.com/GLA. Share your thoughts with us. Tell us how you're doing. Subscribe to the podcast as well. Get it delivered fresh to your feed on the regular every time we drop a new episode. kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together tonight. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for the ear and for your time and attention. Have a great night.